Imagine you are sitting in your office cubicle on a random Tuesday.
Right, just a normal, boring Tuesday.
Exactly. You are drinking your coffee, answering emails, and a guy wearing a corporate polo shirt with like an IT department badge on a lanyard walks right up to your desk.
Looking totally official.
Yeah, completely normal. He is holding a clipboard, gives you a polite nod, reaches behind your computer, and just plugs a USB drive directly into the machine.
And you probably don't even blink.
No one blinks. A few minutes later, he unplugs it, waves goodbye, and walks right out the front lobby doors. But the thing is, that guy didn't work for your company.
Yeah.
He didn't even work for your IT vendor. He is a cyber extortionist. And by simply walking into your building and plugging in a drive, he just completely bypassed millions of dollars in enterprise firewall software, endpoint detection, and, multi-factor authentication.
It's just the ultimate circumvention of traditional security. I mean,
Yeah.
we spend so much time and capital building the tallest, thickest digital walls we possibly can.
Oh, absolutely.
And the attackers are realizing they don't even need to scale the wall if they can just, walk through the lobby.
Walk right through the front door. Welcome to today's daily cybersecurity briefing deep dive. If you are listening to this, you already know that keeping an organization secure feels like an endless arms race.
It really does.
So today, our mission is to explore exactly how modern threat actors are actively bypassing our most robust traditional security perimeters and how the industry is fighting back.
Right.
We have three crucial stories to look at today. First, an espionage group hiding inside the proprietary hardware blind spots of corporate networks. Second, the extortion ring employing the physical actors we just talked about, who skipped the hacking entirely.
Which is still wild to
Yeah, I
me.
know, right? And third, a major software platform that is intentionally hitting the brakes on its own updates to combat a massive supply chain crisis.
It really is a fascinating shift in tactics. Because as our digital front doors get stronger and more heavily monitored, attackers are just being forced to find incredibly creative side windows.
Yeah, they have to adapt.
Exactly. And the underlying theme across all the intelligence we are analyzing today is how threat actors are weaponizing our own infrastructure against us. I mean, we have optimized our environments for seamless integration, instant updates, and human convenience.
Make everything as frictionless as possible.
Right. And now, those exact attributes are the vulnerabilities.
Okay, let's unpack this by looking at how this actually plays out in the wild, starting with a threat actor known as Verdant Bamboo.
Ah, yes, Verdant Bamboo.
Yeah, I was looking through the threat intelligence reports, and depending on who is doing the tracking, this China Nexus group also goes by Clay Typhoon or Warp Panda.
Right, UNC 5221 is another one.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Well, I was reading about a massive intrusion they pulled off recently around September 2025, and the thing that stood out to me was that they essentially ignored the victim's standard servers and laptops entirely.
They didn't even touch them.
Right.
Yeah.
So where exactly were they hiding?
So they targeted the victim's Eggnite storage sync system. For those who might not deal with enterprise storage daily, an Eggnite storage sync is a proprietary network appliance.
Okay.
It usually sits right there in your server room, handling heavy data loads and synchronizing files between local storage and the cloud. But here is the critical detail. It is fundamentally a closed proprietary box.
Right.
And because of that, it traditionally cannot or simply does not run standard EDR, which is endpoint detection and response software.
So it's basically this massive blind spot right in the middle of the server room. It's like a burglar hiding inside a home's smart thermostat because they know the security cameras are only pointed at the doors and windows.
That is exactly what it is. To
Yeah.
get inside, Verdant Bamboo exploited a local privilege escalation flaw within that Eggnite system. And because this flaw wasn't fully patched by the vendor until March of 2026,
Okay, wow, that is a huge gap.
The attackers had an incredibly long window of opportunity. Once they compromised the appliance, they used its own internal proxying capabilities to quietly access the victim's Microsoft 365 environment.
And because they are routing their traffic through the victim organization's own SSL VPN, the security logs just see this as normal, legitimate internal traffic, right?
What's fascinating here is that that is exactly how they evaded conditional access policies.
Oh, right.
A conditional access policy is designed to raise a red flag if someone tries to log in from a weird location, like a different country, or from an unrecognized device. But if the traffic is originating from a trusted internal storage appliance via an established VPN IP
The
address,
system just trusts it.
exactly.
Okay.
The security filters look at it, see a familiar face, and wave it right through. They blended in flawlessly. In fact, telemetry showed that they sat inside this environment for at least 18 months before anyone fully unraveled what was happening.
18 months. Just quietly watching everything. Now, I saw in the technical notes that they deployed a few different custom tools to maintain this access. I know there was a BSD variant of a backdoor called Brickstorm.
Yeah.
But the researchers seemed particularly concerned about a malware family called Plenet, or Grimbolt, depending on who you ask.
Yeah, Plenet is nasty.
And I noticed something about it using, quote, ahead of time compilation. What does that actually mean for the defenders trying to catch this?
That is a great question, because Plenet is a very sophisticated piece of work. Google actually saw it used earlier in mid-2024 via a Dell Zero Day by UNC6201. It's a cross-platform backdoor built in .NET Core. Usually, .NET applications compile into what we call an intermediate language.
Okay, intermediate language, got it.
When security researchers capture standard .NET malware, this intermediate language makes it relatively easy to decompile. Analysts can basically look at the code, reverse engineer it, and figure out exactly what the malware is programmed to do.
Right.
But ahead of time, or AOT, compilation changes the game entirely.
So it's compiling differently before it ever hits the target system.
Yeah. Exactly. AOT compilation turns that intermediate code directly into native machine code specific to the target operating system before it ever runs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. In doing so, it strips out a massive amount of metadata. It makes the payload much smaller, faster, and significantly harder for malware analysts to pull apart and analyze. It demonstrates a very high level of operational security discipline by Verdant Bamboo.
Ah, so it's like translating a detailed book into a completely different language and then immediately burning the original dictionary.
Yeah.
The final product still tells the story, but anyone trying to figure out how you translated it is completely out of luck.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
Yeah.
And even with Plenet, they still had fallback mechanisms. They deployed a third tool called Agent TPSD, which is a Python-based reverse shell.
Just to clarify for anyone who might not be deep into network engineering, a reverse shell means that instead of the attacker trying to aggressively punch a hole through your firewall from the outside in,
yeah,
the malware forces your own compromised server to quietly call out to the attacker. Since firewalls are usually configured to allow outgoing web requests, it just slips right by.
Exactly. They really brought an entire layered toolbox. But
yeah,
we haven't even talked about the craziest part of this story.
Yeah.
How did they even reach this internal storage appliance in the first place?
Right, because it's an internal box.
This is the part that should make every organization reevaluate their supply chain. Verdant Bamboo did not directly breach the victim's perimeter. They compromised the victim by first hacking the victim's managed service provider, their MSP.
Oh, man. If you are listening to this and you outsource your IT support to an MSP, this is the absolute nightmare scenario.
It really is.
You can do everything right. You can lock down your network. But if your vendor is compromised, it's a direct pipeline straight into your environment.
And the specific hardware they compromised at the MSP was a pfSense firewall. They infected the very device designed to keep attackers out, using it as a staging ground.
That is brutal.
From that compromised firewall, they rode the trusted connection right into the victim's network. Even after the victim tried to clean up the initial breach, Verdant Bamboo just used stolen admin credentials over SSH to remotely connect back to the firewall, set up new VPN access, and deploy their malware onto a Synology network-attached storage appliance.
It just proves that you can lock down every laptop and smartphone in your company, but if you have proprietary appliances sitting in the server room, or if your third-party vendor's firewalls aren't actively monitored, you are leaving the vault wide open.
It doesn't matter how secure the endpoints are. They are living off the land in the hardware we inherently trust the most.
Now, if Verdant Bamboo bypasses security by hiding in hardware blind spots, this next group bypasses technical perimeters by hacking the human blind spot. Because, I mean, Verdant Bamboo spent 18 months meticulously hiding, right?
Right, playing the long game.
Hiding takes an incredible amount of patience. But not every threat group wants to wait a year and a half to get paid. Some groups have realized that if you create enough manufactured panic, you don't need to hide at all.
You just manipulate the user.
Exactly. You can just ask the victim to open the door for you.
And that brings us to an entirely different class of vulnerability.
We're talking about a group tracked as UNC3753. You might also hear them called Chatty Spider, Luna Moth, or the Silent Ransom Group. Between January and May 2026, they recently went on a massive tear targeting U.S. professional, legal, and financial services.
Yeah, a very targeted campaign.
And they aren't using complex zero-day exploits. They are using voice phishing, or vishing, a phone call. Wait, they just call people up and ask to be let in?
Essentially, yes.
It's like a vampire needing to be invited into the house.
That's a great way to put it, actually.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating here is the psychology behind their attack chain. They don't just cold call you out of the blue. They lay a trap first. They frequently start their campaigns by sending benign invoice-themed emails from normal consumer email accounts like Gmail or Outlook.
And let me guess, because there is no malicious link and no infected PDF attached to the email, the corporate email security gateways just let it right through because technically it's just a regular text email.
Exactly right. The email is completely clean from a technical standpoint.
Yeah.
But psychologically, it's a bomb. It usually contains a brief message about an upcoming, highly expensive charge or a finalized invoice for something like a premium software renewal.
Just to get the heart rate up.
Right. The sole purpose of that email is to establish a pretext and raise the target's internal alarm bells. Imagine you manage a budget at a law firm and you suddenly get an email confirming a $40,000 charge is about to hit your department. You panic.
And right when that panic is peaking, the phone rings on your desk.
Yep.
And it's the attacker posing as your internal IT help desk. They aren't threatening you. They are offering to rescue you from this massive fraudulent charge. They say, hey, I see that strange invoice activity on your account. Let's stop that charge before it clears. I just need you to join this quick Microsoft Teams or Zoom session so I can see your screen and help you cancel it.
It is incredibly manipulative, and it works astonishingly well. And by getting the victim to initiate a screen sharing session, the attackers accomplish something massive. They completely bypass multi-factor authentication.
Right, because the victim has already logged in. They already used their fingerprint or typed in their code from their phone to get into their own machine. The attacker is just piggybacking on the victim's legitimate, already authenticated session.
Yes. Once the screen share is active, the attacker gently guides the victim to install legitimate remote monitoring tools, software like AnyDesk, BombGuard, SuperOps RMM, or Zoho Assist.
Standard IT tools.
Exactly. These are standard IT tools, so again, the antivirus software usually doesn't block them.
And the way they deliver the installation links is brilliant. They use a legitimate website called privnote.com, which is a service for sending self-destructing notes. The young hacker drops the link in the chat, the victim clips it, reads the instructions, installs the software, and the note vanishes forever.
Yep. There is zero forensic trail left behind for the real IT team to investigate.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. It's not just remote access anymore, like we talked about at the very beginning of the deep dive. The FBI recently put out an advisory highlighting a massive escalation in this group's tactics. They are literally sending physical actors to corporate offices.
Posing as IT technicians.
Yes.
It represents a jarring convergence of cyber and physical threats. We are so conditioned to think of the attacker as someone thousands of miles away in a dark room. The idea that the attacker is standing in your lobby with a clipboard, completely circumventing every firewall you have by physically plugging a USB drive into a machine, breaks every mental model we have about cybersecurity.
It's a manufactured insider threat. And we have to talk about the sheer speed of this operation. When you look at the data, the entire operation from the first phone call to the final data extortion demand often happens within a single business day.
The operational tempo is staggering. Once they have that remote or physical access, they are executing data searches, staging the files, and exfiltrating the data in under an hour. They use standard tools like WinSCP or rClone to push the data out of the network.
And then literally 30 minutes after they leave your network, the extortion email hits your inbox.
30 minutes?
It's wild. They give you a tight deadline. If you don't pay up, they threaten to call your clients directly, email your employees, and dump everything, taxes, SSNs, M&A plans on their public leak site. And they target legal services and financial firms specifically because the reputational destruction of leaking an unannounced merger and acquisition plan is so high.
The victims are highly motivated to pay quietly.
Exactly. And if an organization thinks, well, we'll just track down the IP address hosting their leak site and block it, they are in for a rude awakening. I read a report by ResSecurity that detailed how this group uses an evasion technique called DNS FastFlux to make their infrastructure practically untouchable. Their leak site, business-data-leaks.com, is just a nightmare to block.
Oh, FastFlux is incredibly frustrating for defenders.
Break that down for us. What makes DNS FastFlux so hard to stop?
Normally, a website's domain name points to a static IP address hosted in a major data center, like AWS or Microsoft Azure. If that site is malicious, security teams just blacklist that IP. But FastFlux constantly changes the IP addresses associated with the domain name, sometimes every few minutes.
Wow.
They do this using incredibly short time to live, or TTL, values in their DNS records.
So by the time a security analyst identifies the IP address and adds it to a block list, the domain has already seamlessly shifted to a completely different server.
Exactly. And to make it worse, they aren't using traditional data centers. This entire botnet is spread across 18 different countries and hosted entirely on consumer internet service providers. We're talking about residential home Wi-Fi connections and mobile phone IP addresses.
So you can't just block a massive chunk of IPs.
No, because you'd be blocking the home internet connections of everyday people in Latin America, Eastern Europe, and Central Asia. You would break the legitimate internet for thousands of people just to stop one leak site.
It's an overwhelming level of speed and agility. And that sub-hour timeline really feels like the recurring theme here. UNC3753 uses lightning-fast execution to extort you before you even know what's happening. But in the broader digital world, it seems like the industry is finally waking up to the idea that our obsession with instant zero-latency technology is actually becoming a massive liability.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we are seeing a fundamental shift in how the software industry handles updates, specifically to combat software supply chain attacks.
Right. Which brings us to our third briefing item. Microsoft just announced a major policy change for Visual Studio Code, which is obviously one of the most popular code editors in the world.
Oh, easily.
Starting in version 1.123, they are implementing a mandatory 2-hour delay before any IDE extensions are automatically updated to a newer version. Now, wait, let me push back on this for a second. Doesn't the entire cybersecurity industry constantly scream at us to patch and update our software immediately to stop zero-day exploits? How does slowing down our updates actually make us safer?
It sounds counterintuitive, I know, but it addresses a very specific modern threat developer ecosystem breaches.
Okay.
If a threat actor manages to compromise the account of a highly trusted, popular software developer, they can push a malicious, poisoned update to an extension that is used by millions of programmers. Previously, the auto-update mechanisms in these platforms would pull that poison code down immediately. You would have millions of machines infected instantly before anyone even realized the developer's account had been hacked.
Ah, I see. It's like a bank holding a massive check in escrow before the funds actually clear. You might want the money instantly, but the bank says, let's just hold this for a day and make sure nobody is committing fraud behind the scenes.
That is exactly the mechanism at play here. That intentional friction creates a crucial window of time. It gives the registry maintainers, the community, and the automated security scanners just enough time to spot a potentially compromised release, flag it as malicious, and pull it down before the auto-update triggers on the end user's machine.
And it's not a blanket ban on speed. You can still manually hit the update button if you really need the new feature right this second. Plus, trusted publishers like Microsoft themselves, GitHub, or OpenAI bypass this delay entirely, so it's a targeted speed limit. And Microsoft isn't the only one doing this, are they?
Not at all. We've seen similar minimum release age cooldown features adopted across several major package managers recently. Ruby Gems added it to Bundler version 4.0.13. We're seeing it in platforms like Bun, NPM, PMPM, and Yarn. They all recognizing that the immediate frictionless distribution of third-party code is simply too dangerous in the current environment.
So what does this all mean? If we pull all three of these intelligence briefings together, what is the actionable takeaway for you listening to this deep dive right now? First, you have to look beyond the laptop. You need to audit your edge appliances, your network storage, and your vendor firewalls. If it's a closed box sitting in your server room that can't run endpoint detection, assume it is prime real estate for an espionage group to hide in.
Absolutely. And second, you must aggressively train your staff on the new reality of social engineering. The IT guy on the phone asking for a quick screen share or the technician standing in your lobby with a USB drive is just as dangerous as a zero-day exploit. The human element will always be the softest perimeter.
And finally, we need to start appreciating the friction. When platforms add a 2-hour delay to your workflows, they aren't doing it to annoy you or kill your productivity. They are adding a necessary speed bump to keep your automated systems from instantly downloading poisoned supply chain updates.
This raises an important question, though, and it's something I think we all need to deeply consider going forward.
Mm-hmm.
We have spent the last 20 years building enterprise cultures and digital networks designed for absolute frictionless speed. We demanded zero latency access, instant data transfers, and immediate software updates.
Yeah, we wanted everything yesterday.
Exactly. But we are now seeing threat actors weaponize that very speed against us, whether it's sub-hour data extortion that leaves you no time to react, or instantaneous malicious updates that infect millions in seconds.
We built the digital highways to let cars travel at 200 miles an hour, and now we are shocked that the getaway drivers are using them too.
That's spot on. So the provocative thought we have to leave you with is, this is the future of cybersecurity actually going to require us to intentionally build speed limits and artificial delays back into our technology? Are we going to have to sacrifice the ultimate convenience we've spent decades building in order to survive the threats of tomorrow?
That is a heavy thought to mull over, but absolutely critical if we want to change the math for the attackers.
Thank you for joining us on this daily cybersecurity briefing deep dive. Take these insights back to your teams, check your vendors' firewalls, watch out for the guy in the polo shirt. Stay curious and stay secure.